Turn to Matthew 2 in your Bibles. Matthew is still pounding the same drum. He wants to convince you Jesus is the Messiah. That is Matthew's goal. He wants to convince you Jesus is King. He wants to convince you that Jesus is the long-awaited one, the coming one. Matthew keeps screaming over and over, he's here. And as you're familiar with, Jesus being the Messiah means there's a lot of prophecy he's got to fulfill. He hasn't fulfilled all of it. There's still a second coming. But there's a lot that was fulfilled in his first coming, but there's a confusing aspect to prophecies that if you don't get it straightened out early on, Matthew 2, you'll be a little confused as we read some of these passages this morning. So most of us, when it comes to prophecy, are familiar with just a direct prophecy, right? The Messiah had to be born where? Bethlehem. So guess what? Jesus comes along, where was he born? Bethlehem. Pretty straightforward. The Messiah had to be conceived in a virgin. So Mary, a virgin, conceived a child, it was the Messiah. I mean, those are pretty straightforward prophecies. He's got to do this, Jesus did this. Those aren't the only kind of prophecies that Jesus had to fulfill, though. There are other prophecies that Jesus fulfills, not because the Old Testament said, here's who the Messiah will be, but because the Old Testament sets up this idea that the Messiah will be the pinnacle Israelite. He'll be a Jew of Jews, if you will. The people of Israel will be able to look at him and go, that's our guy. And so there are certain prophecies Jesus fulfills, not because they were originally given as prophecies, but they help him identify as the pinnacle Jew, if you will. You want the Messiah to be a guy where every Israelite can look at him and go, that's the Israelite. That guy leading us in the new covenant, that's the Jew we've been waiting on. And so there are different prophecies that we'll cover this morning that deal more with that. Our text today, Matthew 2, verse 13 to 23, deals with three prophecies, and two of them are those kind. Two of them are prophecies that aren't, if you were reading in your Old Testament, you go through your yearly Bible reading, you wouldn't go, oh, this is a prophecy about who Jesus will be. You wouldn't get that necessarily at the beginning, but Matthew helps bring it up, and we can go back and go, oh, we missed it. So I want to show you some of that this morning. Let's look at Matthew 2, starting in verse 13. Let's read this. Now when they had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, rise, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him. And he rose and took the child and his mother by night and departed to Egypt and remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet, out of Egypt I called my son. Then Herod, when he saw that he had been tricked by the wise men, became furious. And he sent and killed all the male children in Bethlehem and in all the region who were 2 years old and under, according to the time that he had ascertained from the wise men. Then was fulfilled what was spoken by the prophet Jeremiah. A voice was heard in Ramah, weeping in loud lamentation, Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be comforted because they are no more. But when Herod died, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt, saying, rise, take the child and his mother and go to the land of Israel, for those who sought the child's life are dead. And he rose and took the child and his mother and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was reigning over Judea in place of his father, Herod, he was afraid to go there. And being warned in a dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee. And he went and lived in a city called Nazareth, so that what was spoken by the prophets might be fulfilled, that he would be called a Nazarene. Again, we deal with three different sections, dealing with three different prophecies and three different areas of geography. And Matthew, again, is in his introduction of the book of Matthew. And Matthew is pounding away that this Jesus that he's about to give you the account of is the Messiah. So this morning, as we look at these three sections, I want to show you that Matthew identifies Jesus with Israel, he identifies Jesus with sorrow, and he identifies Israel with hillbillies. We'll get to that last one, I promise. Look back at verse 13. You'll see how Matthew does this. How does Matthew make sure Jesus is identified with Israel? Look at verse 13. Now when they, that is the Magi, had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. So here we have the second appearing of an angel to Joseph. The first time was to tell him about Mary and, you know, name him Jesus, different things like that. We've learned now, this is after the wise men had departed, the Magi had departed. In your mind, you got to think this is only a couple days. The Magi go to Jerusalem. It's only 5 miles away from Bethlehem. They talk with Herod. They don't know what he's planning. They go to Bethlehem, which wouldn't have taken long. I mean, how long does it take to go 5 miles? And then they depart. So we're thinking maybe a day or two. I mean, if they don't return after a day or two, Herod knows they've tricked him. We remember verse 12. Look at verse 12. And being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way. So God intervened again and made sure they went home a different way. God keeps intervening and ruining Herod's plan, but that's not his only goal, as we'll see. Look again at verse 13. Now when they had departed, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. And here's what the angel said. Listen, rise, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him. So just in your mental picture, if you can picture Israel, you have Mary and Joseph go from Nazareth down to Bethlehem, and rather than going back up to Nazareth, they go to Egypt. They go about 75 miles over to Egypt. Verse 14, notice again the quick obedience of Joseph. And he rose and took the child and his mother by night and departed to Egypt and remained there until the death of Herod. And the picture we keep getting of Joseph, if you recall last time we were in Matthew, is immediate and quick obedience. I mean, he was told, take her as your wife. He's taking her. He was told, name the child Jesus. Names the child Jesus. He was told not to divorce her. Didn't divorce. I mean, he was told all these different things, and he immediately obeys. And that's exactly what we're seeing again here. Now, one of the questions I have as I'm reading this is I want to know why Egypt? Why would God step in and say, go to Egypt? I mean, think of all the billions of ways God could protect Jesus from Herod. He could kill Herod. I mean, it's not difficult. He could blind Herod. He could make Jesus invisible. He could do a billion different things. And his plan is take Jesus to Egypt. Why Egypt? Well, practically speaking, Egypt is outside of Herod's domain. Herod had no jurisdiction here. So if you go there, you're safe from him. It was only about a 75-mile journey to the border of Egypt, so it's not a terribly difficult journey, although they do have a young child with them. Secondly, in Egypt at this time was a large Jewish population, so he would have fit right in there. They say at this time in Alexandria, in Egypt, there would have been about 1 million Jews. So Jesus and his family would have fit right in there. So it's a place that's safe from Herod. You fit in there. I'm going to keep you here until Herod's dead. I'll protect you here. And two of the things I want you to imagine or notice with me here is, first, think of how sad Israel's state is right now. Jesus, the Messiah, is safer in Egypt than Israel. I mean, think about that. God sends his long-awaited Messiah to his people, and he's got to get him out so he doesn't get killed. And so we see Israel early on in Matthew in a sad state. Things are bad. They need the Messiah to come. But I also don't want you to miss this. This is something that is so easy to overlook. We talk about the Magi, we talk about the gifts they bring, and then we kind of move on to Egypt. Joseph and Mary, as we established last sermon, were poor. They would not have been able to make this journey very easily as poor people. It would have been very difficult to get their whole family to move to Egypt. Well, insert these Magi, and they bring these expensive gifts. They bring these expensive gifts that would have easily been traded in for money. And God, before they even knew they had to go to Egypt, is already providing for them to get to Egypt. And again, we don't want to miss God's just normal and quiet providence in everyday things like that in our life. I mean, God provided for Joseph and his family to get to Egypt before they ever even knew they had to go. And so we see that building in this story. And then Matthew lets us in on the real reason Jesus had to go to Egypt. God could have done a billion different things, as I said before. He could have made Herod go blind. He could have made him eat grass like Nebuchadnezzar. He could have done so many different things. But he sent him to Egypt. And we learn in verse 15, look at this. This was to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet. And what did the Lord say by the prophet? Look, out of Egypt I called my son. Turn in your Bibles to Hosea 11. Hosea 11. You're going to want to turn here because this is going to be helpful to see with your own eyes. You've got to hit that area of your Bible that's stuck together and difficult to miss. The little postcards in there we call letters. Hosea 11. Matthew's letting you know that Jesus going to Egypt wasn't just some weird plan God had. It wasn't just there's no other option. There's very intentional reason to get him to Egypt. Because he can't call him out of Egypt if he doesn't get to Egypt. Okay? And Matthew is saying that Hosea prophesied, out of Egypt I called my son. As I said before, if you were reading this in Hosea, you wouldn't naturally just think, oh, this is a prophecy about what the Messiah will be like. But I want you to see Matthew's logic here. Remember Matthew's goal. Matthew's goal is to connect Jesus as the Messiah. He's the long-expected one that will deliver God's people. He's the new David. He's the son of Abraham. He is the guy they've been waiting on. This is Matthew's goal. So remember that as he quotes this verse, Hosea 11:1. Let's read it. When Israel was a child, I loved him. And out of Egypt, I called my son. So just so we're tracking here, in Hosea 11:1, who is the son? Somebody answer. Israel's the son in Hosea 11:1. This is not saying Jesus is the son. So just wait on that, okay? So in Hosea 11:1, Hosea's reminding people that when God redeemed Israel out of Egypt, he did it because he loved his son. Okay, so that's the point that Hosea's bringing up. What you also need to know is Hosea is a prophet to a people being deported and being sent out of their land. They're going into more foreign territory. Hosea's thinking is, out of Egypt I called my son. Look, God, you loved your son the first time, and that caused you to bring them back from foreign land. I want you to love your son again because they're going into foreign land again and bring them back one day. Let's get this. Look at verse 2 in Hosea 11. The more they were called, the more they went away. They kept sacrificing to the Baals and burning offerings to idols. Yet it was I who taught Ephraim how to walk. I took them up by their arms, and they did not know that I healed them. I led them with cords of kindness, with bands of love, and I became to them as one who eases the yoke on their jaws. And I bent down to feed them. They shall not return to the land of Egypt, but Assyria shall be their king, because they have refused to return to me. Just pause right there. Hosea is saying, look, remember you redeemed them out of Egypt. They're not about to go back to Egypt. Now they're going to Assyria. Redeem them out of Assyria again. Verse 6. The sword shall rage against the cities and consume the bars of their gates and devour them because of their own counsels. My people are bent on turning away from me, and though they call out to the Most High, he shall not raise them up at all. How can I give you up, O Ephraim? How can I hand you over, O Israel? How can I make you like Admah? How can I treat you like Zeboim? My heart recoils within me. My compassion grows warm and tender. So again, you're hearing Hosea appealing to God's love for his son to bring him back. Look at verse 9. I will not execute my burning anger. I will not again destroy Ephraim, for I am God, not a man, the Holy One in your midst, and I will not come in wrath. They shall go after Yahweh. He will roar like a lion. When he roars, his children shall come trembling from the west. Notice verse 11. They shall come trembling like birds from Egypt and like doves from the land of Assyria, and I will return them to their homes, declares Yahweh. So notice the context here. Hosea is saying, look, Lord, you loved your son and you brought him out of Egypt into the promised land. Now, because of discipline, you're driving them into Assyria. Lord, I want your love to bring them back. And God promises in verse 11, hey, they'll be brought back. But there's something else Hosea says that you can't miss with this connection to Matthew. Go back to chapter 3 in Hosea. It's not just that Israel will experience a second exodus. It's not just that Israel will experience a new exodus, if you will. But I want you to notice who's going to lead that new exodus. So when God's people are brought back and restored in the land, who leads that? Chapter 3, verse 4. For the children of Israel shall dwell many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or pillar, without ephod or household gods. Verse 5. Afterward, the children of Israel shall return and seek Yahweh their God, and notice, David their king, and they shall come in fear of Yahweh and to the goodness in the latter days. Notice who's leading them when they come back. David. Well, in Hosea's day, David's long dead. The idea here is a new David, a second David. What has Matthew been laboring so hard to show you so far? Remember the genealogy? Jesus Christ, son of David. Over and over, five times in the genealogy, Jesus is connected to David. Go back to Matthew 2 and you'll start to see his point. In Matthew chapter 2, you'll see what Matthew is getting at. As I told you, Matthew knows that the Israelite that's going to be the Messiah has to be a pinnacle Israelite, if you will. And so Matthew's identifying Jesus with experiences that Israel has had. Both Israel and Jesus have been sent to Egypt for protection. Remember in Genesis, the famine was coming, so God had Joseph sent to Egypt, right? So both were being protected. The babies were being killed. Jesus is sent to Egypt. Both are called God's son. Israel is called God's son. Jesus actually is God's son, so there's that connection. You also have, they were both delivered from Egypt at a young age. Israel is a very new people group delivered out of Egypt. Jesus as a newborn child is brought out of Egypt. And so Jesus is sharing similar experiences with all Israelites. Jesus is even having what we would call a personal exodus, if you will. But Matthew's doing more than that. Yes, Jesus is a pinnacle Israelite, but he's also the one that's come to deliver those people. He is that second David. He is that second David that'll lead that new exodus. Matthew is quoting Hosea because Matthew's wanting to show the people of God, listen, the guy who's going to restore us is here. His name is Jesus, and he was born to Mary in Bethlehem. This is him. That second David we're looking for, Hosea 3, that second Exodus we're looking for, Hosea 11, it's here. Like, this is him. Trust him, and we will be restored. And so Matthew is making the connection that Jesus is not only being identified with Israel, but Jesus as the pinnacle Israelite is fit to be their deliverer. All the people in Israel should have looked at him and trusted him. Okay, where do you want us to go? What do you want us to do? What do you want us to say? Lead us so that we can be restored. You guys know the stories. That's not what's going to happen. But at this point, that's what Matthew's setting up. This is the one we've been waiting on. As the true Israelite, Jesus was the one that was right to lead the people in the new Exodus. So in Matthew 2, Jesus, as part of connecting all this together, is sent to Egypt. He's going to have his own personal Exodus. He's going to be the new David that can lead them back and restore them to the land. He's got all these different connections. And so Matthew fights hard to connect Jesus to Israel. But in Matthew 2, that's not the only connection. Notice also, he connects him to sorrow. There's a very specific reason for this. Look at verse 16. Then Herod, when he saw that he had been tricked by the wise men, became furious. And he sent and killed all the male children in Bethlehem and in all that region who were 2 years old and under, according to the time that he had ascertained from the wise men. So Jesus is clearly identified with Israel through the Exodus, but he's also being identified with them through this sorrowful event. Verse 16 says, then Herod. So after the Magi have left, after Joseph and Mary and Jesus have left, Herod's late to the game. He realizes he's been tricked. It's tricked here. The word could also be mocked. So you can kind of see why he responds so insanely. He feels like he's been duped here. And he's threatened. Again, remember what I said last time. If Herod ain't happy, what? Nobody's happy. This ain't going good. And so verse 16, then Herod saw that he had been tricked or mocked by the wise men. He became furious. You don't want an angry Herod. So what does he do? And he sent and killed all the male children in Bethlehem and in all the region who were 2 years old and under. Now, I'm not trying to minimize this event, but most of us in our mind think of a slaughter of 1,000 babies here. That's not what happened. Notice, he killed all males in Bethlehem 2 years old and under. It would have probably been, if the population, if we understand who it was at that time, would have been about 15 to 20 babies. Now, that doesn't mean, just 15 to 20 babies. That's not my point. The point is, don't think a slaughter of 1 million babies across all of Israel. It was Herod had a very specific plan. That baby was born in Bethlehem. I want the babies there and in the surrounding area killed and make it 2 years old and under just to make sure we get him. And you got to think practically about how terrifying this event would have been. Again, they don't have Twitter. They're not checking what's trending, like, hey, Herod's coming. They don't have the evening news. They don't have any of that. So imagine if your family is just at home, you hear this knock, you go to the door, and the soldier demands to see your youngest child. Let me see your youngest. And you bring your 18-month-old, and he kills your baby right there in front of you and walks away. I mean, you just can't imagine what these people are feeling. So my goal is definitely not to say, well, it was only 15 to 20. I'm just trying to get a realistic picture of what's going on here. You start hearing this wailing in this town, this small town. Like, you start hearing this screaming, and little by little, people start picking up on what's going on. They are literally going in, and if your kid is two and under, they kill him. A boy, if you will. And so there would have been much weeping that night. It would have been a miserable, miserable night. On top of this, notice who's doing the killing. The king of Israel. I mean, think about that for a second. The king that was supposed to, Deuteronomy, supposed to make a copy of the law, the king that was supposed to love the Lord God with all his heart, soul, and strength, Herod's usurped that throne. He has no right to it. He's sitting on it by dirty politics and backwards shenanigans, if you will. And here he is going in as the king of Israel, killing little baby Israelites. Things are, again, terrible. Verse 17, as hard as this is, notice what Matthew says. This is not accidental. Then was fulfilled what was spoken by the prophet Jeremiah. I want you to notice, as terrible as this event was, God was still carrying out his purposes. Again, none of this is meaningless or purposeless. Even in this, God is working out his good and wise will. Notice what he says. Then was fulfilled what was spoken by the prophet Jeremiah. So here again, we have something that Jeremiah says that this event fulfills. And so you have the quote there, verse 18. A voice was heard in Ramah, weeping and loud lamentation. Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be comforted because they are no more. It'll be helpful if we understand what Jeremiah meant in context, and then we'll jump back to Matthew. So you don't have to turn to Jeremiah, just listen. In Jeremiah 31, there's only one verse that is sorrowful. There's only one verse that's downtrodden, and it's verse 15. It's the one Matthew quotes. If you were to go back and read Jeremiah 31, you're reading great promises of not only restoration, like we talked about in Hosea, but also what we call the New Covenant. If you're familiar with the New Covenant, you know Jeremiah 31 is a huge passage for that. So God in Jeremiah 31 is promising, not only I'll bring you back, but I'll give you a New Covenant. And all of these great promises, in verse 15, Jeremiah has this verse, this loud lamentation, Rachel weeping, all these different words. What is he talking about? Well, in context, notice verse 18 in Matthew 2, a voice was heard in Ramah. That was the place when the enemies came in to gather together the children of Israel to take them away. That was where they gathered them. So in Ramah, he would gather all the sons together and then take them to, let's just say, Babylon. So you can imagine, if you will, all these mothers standing there watching their sons being taken off into Babylon. Again, much weeping and much sorrow. This is terrible. Some of these boys aren't even old enough to survive the journey, much less what's going to happen to them when they get there. And so Jeremiah picks up on Rachel, who's long dead by now, and kind of uses her as a symbolism for all the mothers of Israel. It's kind of like, you know, we say today, like, oh, so-and-so is rolling over in his grave. Well, he's not really. We're just giving you the understanding of what he thinks on the situation. Does that make sense? And here, Jeremiah is saying, look, Rachel's weeping. Rachel, representing all these mothers in Israel, are weeping. In Jeremiah's day, the people being taken off, well, God's wanting you to know, look, I'm going to bring them back. And I'm going to give you a new covenant. Rachel weeping over her children, her weeping will be stopped one day. And if you were reading in Jeremiah 31, the very next verse tells her to quit weeping. She is weeping because her children are being taken off. But God says, stop your tears. I'll bring them back. And I'll bring them a new covenant. So again, we see in Matthew connecting this to those babies. You see the picture that all these babies being slaughtered, all these mothers in tears, screaming and wailing. I mean, think of the terror that strikes this little town. And Jeremiah brings up this promise where Rachel's weeping, and not only that, stop the weeping. God's going to fix all this. God's going to restore. He's going to dry up Rachel's tears. How is this fulfilled? It's fulfilled in that Rachel's weeping is ended by the one that was just born. Jesus has come to stop that sorrow. In Jeremiah 31, Rachel was weeping, and God said, stop weeping. I'm going to bring them back. I'm going to have a new Exodus. Remember Hosea. Matthew's saying, that time's now. Rachel's not going to weep anymore. These children didn't die in vain. Like the weeping of Rachel has reached its peak. The one that's going to console her, if you will, is here. And that's what we're getting at in Matthew 2. It seems that Matthew, again, is using this event to say, not only has Rachel's weeping reached the point, a pinnacle, but this is it. She's going to be done weeping because the one that's sent to console her is here. The one that's going to bring the sons back is here. The promise of future restoration is here. And so as before, all of Israel should turn to Jesus with great hope. Hey, here's the one that's going to stop our sons from getting slaughtered. Here's the one that's going to end Gentile rule over us. Here's the one that's going to restore us. That's what they should have been doing. He is here to comfort and lead God's people. But as you know, that is not what happened. And so this gets us to our final point, that Matthew is working to show you Jesus is the pinnacle Israelite. He is the Israelite, the Jew of Jews, because of his connection with the Exodus, because of his connection with sorrow, and then lastly, as I said earlier, his connection with hillbillies. Now, why on earth would I say that? Look at verse 19. So this is maybe a few months later. But when Herod died, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt. So again, God intervenes to give Joseph what to do, saying, rise, take the child and his mother and go to the land of Israel, for, or because, those who sought the child's life are dead. I mean, think of the relief that's coming to Joseph and Mary now. We just want to get back home, tired of traveling, I'm tired of thinking someone's coming to kill my baby. I mean, you can't, as much as I try, I can't imagine what that would be like. To constantly be in fear that someone's going to come kill your baby. And so the people who sought to end your child's life are dead. Verse 21, again, quick obedience. And he rose and took the child and his mother and went to the land of Israel. But, notice this, when he heard that Archelaus was reigning over Judea in the land, in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. And being warned in a dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee. So it seems like Joseph is going to pack up from Egypt and just go back to Bethlehem, which is in the area of Judea. But he hears, like, yeah, I got to go to the land of Israel, but I don't have to go where Archelaus is reigning because he's just as crazy as his dad. If you know much about history, Archelaus was just a chip off the old block. For example, one of his first acts as a new ruler in the area of Judea, he was upset that some of the Jews were honoring some of the martyrs that his father killed. And so what did he do? He gathered 3,000 in the temple and killed all of them. That was one of his first acts as a leader. And in fact, he was so crazy, Caesar ended up banning him and shipping him off somewhere. I mean, he was insane. And so Joseph is afraid to go back to, I'm assuming, Bethlehem. He was afraid to go back to Judea. And God confirms that and uses that to get him to what verse 22 says, Galilee. So just a mental image here for me. They go from Nazareth down to Bethlehem for the birth. They go from Bethlehem to Egypt. And now they're going back to Egypt and not Bethlehem, but straight back up to Nazareth. Why is that? Practically speaking, probably because that's where Joseph and Mary were from. That might be why he went there. But it was also, look at verse 22, and being warned in a dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee. Why? Verse 23, and he went and lived in a city called Nazareth, that what was spoken by the prophets might be fulfilled. He shall be called a Nazarene. The idea here seems to be that there was, a specific purpose in him going to Nazareth. Why is that? Why did I say hillbillies? Why did I make this connection? What is Matthew's goal? Well, you got to think, people would expect the king to be raised near the throne. I mean, it makes sense. The throne's in the south, obviously. And so Jesus is going back, you would expect, if he's the king, get him near the throne, one day he'll take over, that kind of thinking. God often thinks backwards from us, and, or better yet, we think backwards from him. And the idea here is that God's going to have the king be raised in the north. And not just the north, but the podunk town of Nazareth, if you will. It says the prophet said Jesus would be called a Nazarene. Now, where is this quote from? Notice what he says. That was spoken by the prophets might be fulfilled. Some of your versions have quotation marks. Some of your versions don't. The reason for that is there is no spot in the Old Testament that says this. And this is one of the favorite attacks of people. They go, see, Matthew didn't even know his own Bible. Where did a prophet say that Jesus would be called a Nazarene? In fact, Nazareth isn't even mentioned in the Old Testament. What you have is a guy who's not reading very closely. If you'll notice so far, verse 5, verse 15, verse 17, it says, so that what was said through the prophet, singular, would be fulfilled. Or he says the prophet, Jeremiah, would be fulfilled. Here, notice what he says, that what was spoken through the what? Prophets, plural. What Matthew's doing is saying, look, there was a general idea among all the prophets that this is fulfilling. Well, what was that general idea? He shall be called a Nazarene. To help you with this, you remember in John 1 when they said, hey, we found the Messiah. He's from Nazareth. Do you remember the response? Can anything good, what, come from Nazareth? It's like, that was the reputation Nazareth had at the time. For Jesus to be called a Nazarene, he was a nobody. Why was this? Because Nazareth, as I said, was a small town. Nazareth was about 50 acres big. I mean, think about that. Some of you own more than 50 acres. Nazareth was about 40 to 50 acres big. It had about 450 people. For some connection here locally, that would be Strong City's population, about. So imagine Strong City living on 50 acres. Now, for me, it's a little easier. I think of Toomsboro, Georgia. It is Toomsboro, but Toomsboro, B-U-R-R is the way we say it. And so Toomsboro, Georgia, is where my dad's from. To give you an idea of what I mean by a small podunk kind of a town, they just had a big uproar in their town because some people didn't want the Dollar General to come in and some people did. And that was the town battle. That was the way it goes. And so that's where my dad's from, about 450 people. I mean, when you think of a town like that, you don't think much can come out of that. I mean, they talk weird, they think backwards. You don't go out of your way to go see that place. And that's kind of it. The only reason I go there is to go eat at my grandparents' house. And then we're done and we go back. Now I guess I can stop by the Dollar General because that side won. But you get the point. In Nazareth, you had a group of people who were not mentioned in the Old Testament. They were what you could call Hellenized hicks is what some people called them. They were influenced by Greeks. They even had an accent. They were known, one source said, for dropping their H's. I don't know what that sounds like, but I know what an accent sounds like. Think of it this way. In our day, when you're watching a movie, I don't know why, but they never give a doctor a southern accent. Have you ever noticed that? I would love to see a doctor, someone really intelligent, a scientist, some military general, just have a really thick southern accent. And you know why they don't do it, because they give southern accents to the people without teeth. They give southern accents to the people, Southern accents to the people they want to make fun of, right? And I'm used to it. It's okay. Like, I don't expect a doctor to come in and read the x-rays and start black, you know, I don't expect that. Very similar to this idea of Nazareth. Think Toomsboro, Georgia. Think Strong City, Kansas. I don't know much about Strong City besides their population, so sorry if that's not accurate. But all the prophets agreed that Jesus had to be downtrodden, downcast. We just read it, right? Man of what? Sorrows. What a name. I mean, he came and not much was going to be made about him. He did not come to be a king in the sense of come and immediately start reigning. Everyone knew who he was. He looked important. He dressed important. That wasn't who he was. You can go through prophet after prophet and see prophecy after prophecy that Jesus was coming in a humble, in an insignificant way, in a way that doesn't matter. People ridicule it. For example, you're familiar with this one. Isaiah 53, verse 2 and 3. For he grew up before him like a young plant and like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him. He had no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And as one from whom men hid their faces, he was despised and we esteemed him not. Again, all of this was to say that Jesus would come in humiliation. Part of that meant being raised in Nazareth. If you recall in Acts, there's a part where the Christians are being ridiculed and they call them the sect of Nazarenes. I mean, again, just more derision. I mean, think about that when you hear people call him Jesus of Nazareth. I mean, every time you read in the gospel, someone says, oh, that's Jesus of Nazareth. They're reminding you, oh, that's Josh of Toomsboro. Like, pff, big deal. That's kind of a dig each time when his enemies are saying it. So again, we're learning through Matthew what to expect in the Messiah and how Jesus did that. Whatever the Messiah was supposed to be, Jesus is. Messiah was supposed to be a son of David? Matthew 1, so is Jesus. Messiah was supposed to be a son of Abraham? So is Jesus. Messiah was supposed to be conceived in a virgin? So was Jesus. Messiah was supposed to be born in Bethlehem? Check. He's supposed to be, Hosea says, the new David who leads the new Exodus? Matthew says, check. He's supposed to be the solution to Rachel's tears? Check. And then here, he's supposed to be a nobody from Nazareth? Check. So Matthew, again, over and over, is showing you Jesus is who they were expecting. And the question, again, is, are you convinced of that? That Matthew's working hard to say Jesus is the king. That's the same question he's posing to you. Again, when you wake up, when you think, when you parent, when you relate to your spouse in marriage, when you go to work, are you actually convinced in all those areas Jesus is king? Because for us to sit here and ridicule Jews who didn't see that and then us go out and live contradictory to it is not much better. We've barely even begun to scratch the surface in Matthew, and it's already so obvious. Jesus is exactly who he needed to be. And so my prayer is that you'd stick with us as we continue in Matthew and watch God sovereignly unfold every little promise in Christ. Just in chapters 1 and 2, it's been so encouraging to see exactly what God promised he did. And as I say over and over again, God is not a man, God is not a liar. He always keeps his word.